Good evening, everyone. Thank you for sitting with me. I was wondering if anybody felt brave enough or outgoing enough to share if you had any moments of awe or mystery. Could be something small, something big. Just a few words to describe. Yeah, go ahead, Deborah. You have to unmute yourself.
I went for a walk with a friend today and her two dogs. They're playful and energetic and big. And she took me to a place in the woods I'd never been before. It was peaceful. It was fragrant. There were towering redwood trees. Had to climb, which I haven't done for a while. So I had to climb up and climb down. And we sat in an area that's called the Cathedral. I'm sure there are lots of places in Redwood Forests that have places called the Cathedral. And we just sat there and took in the sky and the trees and the light. And the dogs got quiet and snuggled up. And I was in heaven. And I was in awe. I was just in awe of the beauty that's here for us.
Thank you. It's really beautiful. Thank you.
It was a lovely treat for me.
Thank you. Anybody else? I can't see everybody, so forgive me if I have to scroll through and make sure I catch everybody. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm Cherie.
Oh, hi.
And so the other day, I was walking down the beach along the ocean. And when I started, I was in kind of a cranky mood. And I just decided that I was going to walk until I felt better, you know. And I did feel better. When I first got down to the beach, there were a bunch of children swimming. And I noticed around the children, there was a group of dolphins swimming just beyond where they were. And as I went down the beach about a mile or so, I saw this big black thing come up and I thought it was a boat or something. And then it disappeared. And then it happened a few more times and I realized it was gray whales. And it was just like, I just thought about, you know, everything that's under that sea going on that we don't really know what's going on under there. And it was kind of tickling. I thought about the dolphins maybe were protecting the children. And it's just like a whole community under there.
It's nice.
Thank you. It's so evocative. To hear these. I feel like there's a little resonance. I wonder if there is for some of you too, a little resonance. Maybe not for everybody, of course. Everybody's different. More? I want to hear at least one more, if not two more. Yeah, Mary, go ahead.
So this is something that happened more than 35 years ago. I'd given birth to my first child. And it was like probably when the first time I was holding him in my arms. I had a C-section, I'm holding him in my arms. And I can picture the view out the window and I'm holding him. And it was as if the moment was just caught because I became the universal conduit for unconditional love. And in that moment, I could just feel it just rushing through my being. And I'm holding this precious child. And I know there's biological explanations for how that child came about. But it was an effing miracle. I mean, I was just in awe and filled with love. It was just the most amazing experience. I'm really grateful that I had it because kids are really difficult. So it was very helpful to have that experience when you're up for hours and stuff. So it was good. Yeah.
Thank you. Cool. Anybody else have one? Yeah. Jan? I see a hand. Jan? Yeah.
Yeah. Mine's really simple. Where I live, there are a lot of trees around and I can't always see the moon. But when I can and I step outside, especially night before last and last night, look up, it just makes me so happy to see the moon. I just like, yes. And I allow myself to feel the awe of the bright sky and the moon. I almost want to stay up all night and watch it, but I don't.
I love how you said you allow yourself to feel the awe. I think that's really beautiful. I'm going to come back to that later. Is there anybody else I'd hate to miss if anybody had one they wanted to share? Let's see. I've been asking people this question all week.
Okay. It's by the way, I'd like to invite people to use the raise hand thing because that always appears in the upper left-hand corner for Ashley. I didn't. I just cheated and unmuted myself. All right. So experience of awe. Our first total eclipse of the sun. It's not something that everybody gets, but we both wept.
Yeah. Thank you. So I've been asking, like I said, I've been asking this question all weekend. Somebody spoke about how her mom had died 3 years ago. So this was, just this week she was talking about, it was around 3 years ago that her mom had died and that she was with her mother through the process. It was a little bit like the opposite of, instead of a natural birth, it was a natural death where her mom was at home and surrounded by her family and loved ones. And she said that that experience was so awe-inspiring and dropped her into that sense of mystery and connection, like the powerful death experience. I also love how I've been asking people this question and most of the answers are from nature. Isn't that really interesting? I think that's really interesting. Most of the answers are from nature, and even death is a natural phenomena. But I did ask this question, somebody this week, a couple people also talked about, which I would say is not that different from nature. A couple people were saying being awe-inspired by inspiring people in history, like historical figures, and the strength in particular of some women that they had been studying and learning about. And then somebody else talked about, she's a Dharma teacher, so maybe it's a little bit of, so she said to me that she had started a Sangha through the internet. It's an internet thing. And she had started the Sangha and she was in awe of the power of intention and the power of the Sangha, the community. And I thought that was really interesting too, like that sense of awe from the Dharma itself, from the teachings and the community. So I have a quote from you from Sri Nisargadatta. Sri Nisargadatta was an Indian teacher, Indian guru, and he died in 1981 or so, something like that. So not too ancient in sort of the historical context of what we are practicing. But anyway, so Nisargadatta said, after all the yogas. So, when we do meditation, that is a type of yoga. It's a yoga in the sense of not like yoga, like a body shape, but it's a method to some results. And there are many different yogas. So the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path, and those are all methods. Each of those eight aspects of the path are all methods, are practices, are things to do to some results. So Sri Nisargadatta said, after all the yogas, whatever their source and character, have only one aim: to save you from the calamity of separate existence. So what we're doing, in some ways, you could think about the yoga of our Dharma practice, the yoga of the Eightfold Path, the yoga of our meditation, is to save you from the calamity of a separate existence. So I've been exploring this topic of awe and mystery this week, and I've been exploring it in tandem with this word surrender. Like, surrender implies a kind of giving over of maybe the ego, or a giving over to something bigger than ourselves. And so surrender. So what are we surrendering when we come to our practice? What are we surrendering when we are coming to into a space of awe and mystery, when we allow that to happen? In some ways, we're surrendering our sense of a separate existence. I think that's maybe one of the reasons why so many of us find awe and mystery in nature, because when we're in nature and we let go of the internal preoccupations, our busyness, our trying to manage and control anything, when we let go of that, we are surrendering into that sense of connection that is in nature, that's all around us. We are surrendering the view that we exist outside of nature. We are surrendering the view that there is a me that needs defending, that we can do it all on our own, that awakening is maybe something that you could do by yourself somewhere in a little cave in the Himalaya, maybe somewhere, but it's not true. We can't do anything alone, because that's not the nature of the world. So I was asking myself, too, when I was thinking about this topic, why am I using the word surrender versus renunciation or letting go? So we might hear about, in this tradition, we might hear about renunciation, and we might see the monastics and how they are renouncing for freedom. And I think for me, the word surrender really implies this letting go into something bigger than me. Something bigger. Whereas when I hear the word renunciation, it implies like something that I'm going to do, or that I'm going to accomplish. And I understand that you might have a different connection with the words, and maybe for you, the word surrender doesn't work. So you can transpose that word as you listen to me speak in your mind to renunciation. As I think they have a similar flavor, maybe slightly different. It would be a great discussion question for us too. So you could say, for us to allow the space of mystery, for us to come into deep connection, in some ways we have to let go of our habits of mind. We have these deep grooves in our mind and our bodies of habits that sometimes it can be really helpful to let go of. I know this week the moon has been coming to full. I think it's full today, in fact. But one night this week, Joe said to me, he's like, my husband, he's like, oh, look outside, the moon is rising. And I knew, like, oh, I'm supposed to feel awe or mystery right now, but I wasn't there, right? Like, I was in some sort of little habit or groove, and it didn't arise. And that can happen to us sometimes. And that, I think, in some ways is pointing to this sense that the awe and the mystery can just arise, that it's not another thing that we need to figure out how to do and put it on our to-do list. I run lists all the time, and I could write on my list, find awe when looking at moon. I don't know. It's not really quite like that. It's not really quite what I mean. Sometimes our stereotypes and habits of mind, stereotypes can color what we see. I was, listening to this podcast, and a scientist was talking about how our language, the language that we learn, actually determines how we see the world. Isn't that so interesting? Like, some groups of people don't have numbers in their language, so they won't develop algebra. Or some different cultures maybe don't have as many nouns. Everything's a verb, is a process. So our language itself, and if we don't even know that we're in a soup of our language, it can really limit our idea, or limit our sense of mystery, or limit our ability to come into intimacy with the present moment. So the shifting into awe and mystery is a shifting into not knowing, or maybe letting the rational mind take a little back seat. Our culture rewards concepts, knowing. There's so many lists. I love the list. I love so many. There's so many Buddhist lists, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And there's like lists upon lists upon lists. I think it's so interesting. But that knowing all the lists doesn't actually, doesn't shift me out of, as Nisargadatta said, the calamity of a separate existence. The knowing the list might help, and it might support my mind, and it might help my development. But the actual experience of awakening is a kind of surrender, a letting go of the rational mind, perhaps. Letting go of the need for proof or looking for proof in everything. So I'm not saying that knowing is wrong or bad. Learn all those lists. It's really actually great to know them, to know it. But I am asking us to consider that it's maybe not all it's cracked up to be. And it's not the whole of the path or the practice. Knowing the information is not the same as embodying it. Reading a book, reading a cookbook is not the same as tasting the meal, right? Like the sense of awakening is happening in the moment, in the intimacy of the moment. So the rational mind can sometimes be privileged. It can be privileged through patriarchy and colonialism. And yet each of us, no matter what culture we grew up in or where we are with our privilege, we all carry our own ways of knowing. Our own ways of knowing that are different or beyond or different than the rational mind, than the controlling mind. And so we can learn, we can actually learn how to revere the great mystery in all things. And everything, every single little thing is actually a great mystery and connected to everything else. This is actually the teaching on codependent arising, how everything arises together, but it's not separate. And that because of that, it's all actually a great mystery, and it's a great sacredness or holiness. You can think about yourself and your life and how you yourself are an expression of the infinite intelligence of the universe arising, right? Never seen before, never to be seen again. It's actually a great mystery and a great holiness. So from Einstein, Einstein said, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. I guess it's such an interesting quote because they think of Einstein as like the science guy and he discovered all this amazing stuff. But he said, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. They who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe is as good as dead. Their eyes are closed. So we might actually carry with us a real distrust of not knowing, of surrendering the rational and the conceptual. Sometimes it doesn't feel safe to do that. Yet nature itself is very puzzling. It's confusing. It allows paradox, multiplicities, and doesn't always rely on language. And sometimes we become too busy to touch into the mystery. And we often are living, whether due to our history, due to our parents' history, due to living in a city, so our conditions. So we're often, due to so many different conditions, might be living in a state of hypervigilance, which can make it difficult to relax into or to surrender into something bigger. Sometimes we're just plumb busy, like the life circumstances that we're just so busy as to cover over this great mystery. But the invitation with our practice, and see if you believe this, see how it resonates with you. The invitation with our practice of mindfulness, with such an unfortunate name as mindfulness, it sounds so dry and controlling to me. But anyway, with our practice of mindfulness, we can let go of managing ourselves, managing our bodies, managing our practice, managing our experience. the sense how we're always trying to control, even when we sit down to meditate, often we're just trying to control and manage our experience. Whereas the quality of mindfulness is a quality of attention that's remembering that you're here, remembering that you're meditating. This word sati, which gets translated as mindfulness, also means to remember. So we're holding ourselves, we're remembering what we're doing. It has nothing to do, it doesn't say we're controlling ourselves, it's just remembering that we're meditating. So this kind of attention that's mindfulness is non-judgmental, not managing. So we can, with our practice, sometimes, if the conditions are right, rest into mystery. There are actually in your presence here tonight mystery and possibility that we maybe can't even know with the rational mind. We cannot know what our practice will lead to. There's just no way to know what your practice will lead to. The mind wants to know, the mind thinks it might know, the mind has many ideas, but we can't always know. We don't know what our practice will lead to. We don't know what ripples and downstream effects come from small moments of kindness or small moments of presence. Maybe today you were offhandedly, without even remembering it, kind to someone else, and it impacted them so deeply. I've heard enough stories about that, actually, from people receiving kindness. There's even bumper stickers about it, practice random acts of kindness. Because we just don't know. The rational mind it has the tendency to want to judge, like, oh, I'm not a very good meditator and my practice is really sporadic and I really should be doing this and that and that. But we just can't know. Don't be fooled by those kind of thoughts. It's just the mind trying to evaluate things. But we can't know. We can't know the effect of our practice, of our ethical behaviors, and our compassion. The truth is that we just don't know. We can instead become curious about all of the possibilities. So this tradition that we practice in, there's many stories and teachings about demons and celestial beings and past lives and superhuman powers. And maybe it's not so rational to think about those sort of ideas or those teachings, but perhaps we could just hold that in just a little bit of, oh, I don't know. It's not my experience. I don't have an experience of a past life that I have a memory of, but I could hold it lightly and hold the kind of mystery. So I guess it's time goes so fast. Maybe even 10 years ago now, I went to Myanmar, to Burma, to practice in a monastery. And I went during the rainy season, so there weren't very many Westerners there. And I was in a monastery with Utejin Nia. And sometimes there was a Dharma talk every day. Most mornings, the Dharma talk was in Burmese. And many times when the monk was giving the Dharma talk in Burmese, the style was to sing it. So I would be sitting in a meditation hall listening to a Dharma talk in a foreign language that was being sung. And I have to say, there was some sort of understanding or transmission. It wasn't a kind of rational thing, but this sense of in the world that maybe there's a possibility that you could receive a Dharma talk in a different language and you might hear it in your heart. So we can experience for ourselves the possibility of the power of awareness. We can experience for ourselves all that is possible when we connect to the physical body as nature, which is impermanent and not so. Then our practice becomes the practice of surrendering defenses. Sometimes I do think that culturally, there's a tendency for the rational mind to be a bit of a defense against the vulnerability of being a human being, a defense against things that we don't want to feel. I've noticed for myself, and I've talked to a bunch of other people, that often when there's something in meditation that we don't want to feel, or there's something happening that we would prefer not to feel, the mind does what the mind does, which is to think it's its gift to try and help us with this uncomfortable or painful thought or painful feeling, instead of just being with it. So that the rationality, the thinking and the overthinking becomes a bit of a defense mechanism. When we lower our defenses, we become more flexible. So what about this refuges? You know, at the beginning of our practice in this Sangha, we sing the refuges, the three refuges, the refuge of the Buddha, the refuge of the Dharma, and the refuge of the Sangha. So I've been using the word tonight, surrender in particular, and on purpose versus renunciation. And surrender is, again, as I was saying before, it's implying that we're surrendering to something bigger, this kind of letting go. And what is bigger and more amazing and more powerful than the Dharma, than the refuges, right? Like these three jewels, the refuge of the awakened mind, the refuge of the community, and the refuge of the teachings themselves. So the Dharma really asks, or the teachings ask for a deep kind of surrender. And through that, paradoxically, we become more and more independent because we're less reactive, because we're more, more in alignment with Dharma, with the way things are, more in alignment with impermanence. So the Dharma, the teachings are asking for a deep kind of surrender to the refuge of the Dharma and the awakened mind and the Sangha. And through that surrender, we become more independent. Isn't that so interesting? As we begin to practice mindfulness, we somehow, maybe little bits at a time, learn to let go of trying to control and manage everything, and instead can develop a kind of self-confidence that's not dependent on the outer circumstance. We can become more confident in our own capacity to meet each moment, to meet each moment, just one moment at a time. So all of us, every single one of us, are taught and have to some degree or another a thirst to exert power and control over ourselves and over life. Do you recognize that word thirst? It's a translation, a tanha, which causes our suffering, to refer back to the Four Noble Truths. That which is causing suffering is our thirst, our tanha, right? The thirst to exert power and control over ourselves and our lives. I was talking to this woman the other day, and she had been traveling, and she caught COVID while she was traveling. And so she ended up having to be in a hotel room by herself for a week. And she said that it was really hard, but also really amazing, because it gave her a chance to kind of look at what she was doing in her life and what was going on. And she said she felt like, and I'm telling this story because I feel like she stands in for really actually how many, if not all of us at times or other in our lives do this too. But she said she felt like she was using her life and her body as a kind of tool to get to these ideas, like, oh, she needs to have career success and her family. And like she felt like she was somehow using her body as a tool to get some outcome, and that she could see that because she had this opportunity where she couldn't work, she wasn't feeling well, and she had this opportunity to just be with herself for a week. And, you know, it wasn't easy for her, but it allowed her to see the bigger picture and see that she didn't want to do that. She didn't want to keep using her body as some sort of tool. That instead she was interested in connecting to and exploring joy and exploring finding a sense of ease in her life instead of trying to manage everything and get ahead. Isn't that, I think that's so interesting and really beautiful. We have this in our culture too, right? Like that if we can control everything, we will be happy and rich and we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And it doesn't matter if you're part of a class that's a part of a group of people that's historically oppressed or currently oppressed, that if you just do enough effort and pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you can succeed, right? Like that sense that we have, this idea in our culture that somehow forgetting or denying that we are all deeply connected and that we are all deeply connected and sway to all the different circumstance that we are arising in. So you could talk about really our practice as coming into a kind of partnership with life, and that we can let go or surrender the idea that we will get awakening or get a perfect life or any other fixed state by ourselves on our own. That instead we're partnering, that we're partnering with our Sangha. Really, like I couldn't be here if I hadn't learned from my teachers, who learned from their teachers, who learned from their teachers all the way back to the Buddha. It's actually boggling that there are people for millennia that have been interested in awakening, that have been practicing and studying the cultivation of wisdom and compassion. And that everything that I do in my life is dependent on other people and other things, the sun and the sky and the trees and the earth. So we are partnering with the Dharma. When we start our practice, we're partnering with the teachings, we're partnering with the Sangha, the community of people. We're partnering with our own awakened qualities. It's like gardening. I've been gardening a lot recently for the last 20 years. But anyway, I've been gardening a lot recently. And the work is never done. When I'm gardening, the work is never done. It's all a process. It's all an unfolding. So your life is a process. It's an unfolding and we can't force anything. So I can't go out into the garden and look at the flower and try and pull apart the little petals so that I can force it to bloom. I can actually try and get the flower to bloom a little sooner, maybe by controlling the circumstance. So the condition, so this kind of partnership model, this relational model. So I don't know what I could do to make the flower bloom a little sooner, but I can't force it. Does that make sense? That it's not an ego. It's not a willpower in this metaphor. It's a sense of partnership. I was listening to a talk this morning from Ajahn Suchito, who's a monastic. I actually took notes and I want to read this little note that he said. So he was talking about mindfulness of the body in this talk. And he said, to be in the body, it is a relational experience and there is a lot of love needed. So love not as a sentiment or as an erotic pleasure. He's saying that the love that's needed to be in the body, the love that's needed to be in our practice, to be in our life, the love that is needed is the rock bottom willingness to relate. It's a willingness to relate to the whole thing, a willingness to relate, to be calm, kindly, non-reactive, and spacious. And that when we're practicing mindfulness, we're trying to get out of the domination paradigm, and instead just listening and feeling. So this kind of relational or partnership model. So our teachers ask for the whole life to Dharma, do they not? What are the little things that happen in your day so that the Dharma is not just on your meditation cushion? The teachers ask me, and then I ask my students, like, what happened today and how can you see it through a lens of Dharma? So that we're giving over our whole life to Dharma, that we can find Dharma in all the stories and all our experiences. And that we can perhaps let go of efforts to control the nature of our spiritual growth. It's like we're all on this journey and we don't know where we're going. It's like, I love this metaphor. It's like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Do you all remember that movie? I don't know if they still play that. I don't know if there's young people who may not know it as well. But like Dorothy, the whole time she's trying to get home. She's trying to get home. And this is us. We're on our path. We're on the path and we're doing our Eightfold Path. We're doing our wise mindfulness and we're doing our wise ethical behavior. And we're doing what, right? We're doing all the practices. We're on the yellow brick road. We're on the yellow brick road. And it turns out that just like Dorothy, we're already home, that we are in fact connected and that the mystery is here. And we just need to surrender and let go and remember the mystery, remember the awe. So we often want our life and our circumstance and practice to be under our own authority and power. But the Dharma, the teachings are more than we can understand. And that our practice seats us into intimacy with life and with each other. And that we are practicing and learning a kind of flexible responsiveness. There are certain kinds of growth that only happen when the ego is all out of moves. Mindfulness gets richest when we have less and less interest in exerting control over our experience, over our path, and we become released into a realm of wonder and vitality. Vitality because we don't know, we are willing to not know, willing to surrender. So rather than trying to optimize your meditation, we begin to relate to ourselves. We begin to surrender. So you are not a tool. You yourself, your life, your body are not tools to be manipulated into some shoehorn of some sort of preconceived idea of what life should be, what your practice should be. We can instead stand totally naked to the moment, undefended in the face of life itself on the meditation cushion so that we practice it on the meditation cushion so that it can be with us when we're in our life. We can open the heart. So a very famous quote from Dogen, Zen Master Dogen. To be enlightened is to be intimate with all things. So may we surrender in ways to find our own power. May we use power for the welfare and benefit of everything and everyone that we encounter. And then I have a poem for us to finish, and it's a poem that's a little bit like a meditation. If you wanted to close your eyes, you could. This is by Joy Harjo. It's called Remember. I love this poem that it's called Remember, and that the word for mindfulness can be translated as to remember. So anyway, she says, remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon. Know who she is. Remember the sun's birth at dawn. That is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away to night. Remember your birth, how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father. He is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them. Listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind. Remember her voice. She knows the origin of this universe. Remember, you are all people, and all people are you. Remember, you are this universe, and this universe is you. Remember, all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember, language comes from this. Remember the dance language is, that life is. Remember. All right, everyone. Thank you for your attention this evening. Thank you.